Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Retired English professor Carol Burr is an author, editor, and artist who illustrated The Birds of Bidwell Park. Roger Lederer has published many books and papers in the field of ornithology and collaborated with his wife, Carol Burr, on their previous book, The Birds of Bidwell Park. Their newest book, Latin for Bird Lovers, covers the secrets behind more than 3,000 scientific names of birds and why those names were selected. Roger Lederer and Carol Burr, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there's a paragraph in your book that especially struck me because I took Latin in high school, and it was not at the time that I appreciated that teacher, but after I graduated, I wrote a letter to this teacher and thanked her for what she had done, what I had learned from her. So when I saw this paragraph in your book, I was reminded that you thank various people who helped with the creation of this book, and then you say, we would like to thank our high school Latin teachers who had a major influence on us in our careers and pleasures. We didn't realize the benefit at the time, but such is the risk and value in educating the young. And I'm sure that would give encouragement to teachers who feel like maybe at the time, did I really get through to those students? And Carol, you say you taught Victorian literature.
Absolutely.
And so it may be only down the road.
You hope so, because these things are hard work at the time, and you're not sure the relevance to your life. And I think it's an argument for not making a determination on relevance until you are at least 60.
Oh, 60.
Yes, I'm pushing it back. I put it back a decade as I pass one. Yes, because I really think young people just don't know, and I think they need everything they can get. So I do think that this was a very unusual way to come back to something. It was a benefit for vocabulary, and I always appreciated it for that, but not for writing a book about bird lovers here.
So as I read this book, I was thinking that this is a book for bird lovers and a book for word lovers. And I don't know much about birds, but I do love words. So I was imagining as I was reading this that maybe that was the area that you focused on. And then, of course, the expertise on birds, Roger, that's your field.
Yes.
So how did you divide up the kind of the assignments of writing this book?
Well, I did more of the scientific kinds of things, and she did the pronunciations and the meaning of some of the words. You know, we both overlap in that Latin area, but it was ornithology that was my thing. And so I tried to pick out the names that were the most commonly used. I mean, there are 10,000 species of birds. So I tried to pick out some of the more common genera and species that, you know, people would see often. So this only covers 3,000 names, but they're or 10,000. Somebody did write a book who covered 20,000 names, actually, old ones and new ones, but it's 450 pages long, you know, with a font 10, and it just goes on and on and on. You wouldn't want to read that, but it's a great reference.
Well, speaking of reading, I really enjoyed reading this book, and I hope that people won't think, oh, Latin, I don't know anything about Latin, and think that's all it is, because it's so much more than that. And it was so thought-provoking. I found myself stopping and thinking, oh, I wonder about that, and going to the computer and Googling, for example, New Latin. I thought, New Latin? And so, Roger, you're talking about the pronunciations. And how did you arrive at, Carol, since you did the pronunciation,
yes,
how did you determine what pronunciation? Because there may not be general agreement.
Well, that's true. I mean, I definitely started out not understanding that scientific Latin, New Latin, is post-Renaissance, and I had learned classical Latin.
Which we all do if we study Latin in high school.
And so I spent the first A and B sections of the book doing classical Latin pronunciations, and then I went back and started understanding better what Carl Linnaeus was doing, and that's really what the pronunciation is a combination, in a way, of some of the ecclesiastical Latin, some of the classical, and then just some of what the scientists sort of decided on. I went back and redid my A's and B's because it was clear that I had not done that correctly. So it was, and then, of course, the other thing that happens with this is that a number of birds have been named after people. And then what we did there was try to make the name as true to its native pronunciation as possible.
Like Linnaeus himself.
Yes.
You often see his name Latinized.
Exactly. Yes. Carolus.
Carolus Linnaeus.
Carolus Linnaeus,
right.
Yes.
From Carl von Linné.
Right. Yeah. So
my guests are Roger Lederer and Carol Burr, And they have a new book, Latin for Bird Lovers. And we're talking about the Latin aspect, but there's so much more in this book than just a list of these names that birds get two names. And what other information did you decide to include in this book, Roger?
Well, we have some biographies of bird watchers or famous ornithologists, and we put a couple in there who I thought were really interesting. James Bond, a lot of people.
I thought those.
Yeah, yes. A lot of people don't know that James Bond was actually an ornithologist, a well-known one. And Ian Fleming, who met him in Jamaica, eventually met him in Jamaica, actually named a character 007 after James Bond without asking James Bond. And then they finally met. And in fact, it was filmed by BBC. And then the other one is Phoebe Snetsinger, who I thought was a terrific woman. Phoebe Snetsinger spent some 20 years after she was diagnosed with terminal cancer. She spent another 20 years, took up bird watching, and saw more birds than anybody else in the world up until that point. And she was killed in a car accident in Madagascar, but she got to be really well known because of what she did.
Mm-hmm. You know what else I found, besides the fact that James Bond was a real person, he was an ornithologist, but I imagined this figure being born in England. He was born in Philadelphia.
Right.
And ended up dying in Philadelphia. But this real person, James Bond, was actually born in the United States.
Right.
His father was British, you say, in your book.
The other thing I think that's really interesting about the book is that when we were talking about putting the book together, there was a book called Latin for Gardeners. And it gave the term and it gave the plant, but it didn't make the connection between the scientific name and the name by which we tend to know the plant. And I thought what Roger had added to the mix was trying at least in a fairly contracted way to explain why a bird might be called something, sort of why. Maybe you can give a good example.
Well, there's a lot of names that are pretty standard. They're named after colors, they're named after people, they're named after shapes, and, spotted or striped, fasciata is striped, those kinds of things. But I had a hard time finding a few things, and one of them was imperfecta. One was named something imperfecta, was a species name, and I'm trying to figure out why would they name this imperfecta? And it took me hours, but I finally found a paper written in the 1800s that described the specimen. All these names are based on one specimen that was collected somewhere, which is why, like the great horned owl, Boo Boo virginianus, because it was first described in Virginia. And so this bird named imperfecta, why would they name it imperfecta? Well, it turns out at that time they used to shoot birds. And this one was so badly shot up, it was missing half its feathers and was an imperfect specimen, so they named it imperfecta, which, of course, really has nothing to do with the living bird.
The bird itself, mm-hmm. Yeah. My guests are Roger Lederer and Carol Burr. Their book is Latin for Bird Lovers. They're both retired professors from California State University, and it makes for a very interesting collaboration because I was always interested in biology and languages and thought, well, now how could those possible be there an overlap there? But there is in your case. So in your book, you give the list of the scientific names. People can look that up. You give profiles of people who have contributed to our knowledge of birds, and you have topics about birds that I found so fascinating. And for example, feathers. I mean, we know what feathers are, but when I read your section on feathers, I thought, I had no idea.
Mm.
So what did you include in your section on feathers that might surprise people like me?
Well, I just got done reading another book, actually, on feathers, which had a lot more detail than this does.
But information is very concise, and I like that.
But very concise. Well, the feathers are amazing. I mean, they produce insulation. They produce lift. They produce not only insulation for the bird, but insulation for the babies. They produce either fast flight or slow flight. There's all kinds of different feathers. The pin feathers are tactile, so the bird knows where his other feathers are. Those kinds of things. They're amazing inventions.
Well, for example, I don't know if listeners noticed the order in which you said that. You didn't say birds are for, that feathers are for flight, which most of us assume, well, that's why feathers evolve for flight. But you said you named insulation first.
That's apparently why they evolved, insulation, although there's some discussion about that. Maybe the first reason they came about was just insulation. We know dinosaurs, birds are modern dinosaurs. We know dinosaurs, some of them were warm-blooded, and they had to you know, insulate themselves somehow so they didn't lose their body heat, and feathers are one way of doing it. Some of the new information also says that it used to be that feathers evolved from scales of reptiles. They didn't. They were separate evolutionary process to produce feathers. There was some argument about that, but over the last 12 years or so, they've decided that's probably what it is.
So feathers for insulation, feathers for flight, and then there's a third use of feathers, or fourth.
For decoration. Obviously, they've become, you look at the birds of paradise, they're absolutely amazing animals who have this sexual selection. They have all these displays with their fancy feathers as well as sounds that attract females.
So they're feathers for courtship, but also for camouflage. Some of these little tiny birds are pretty vulnerable.
You know, cryptocoloring is very important. The other thing I thought was fascinating about the owls is they have sort of fraying on the feather so they can fly silently. And for a predator, that's not a bad strategy.
Sneak
for
up on your prey if your feathers are quiet.
Yeah, except in the case of Pell's fishing owl that feeds on fish, they don't fly silently, but you don't have to
they
when
don't
they
have
feed
to.
On
if they're
fish.
Underwater, yeah. Well, there are these specialized feathers that you mentioned, and I thought it was interesting that from what you described, I imagine that for the reason that cats have whiskers, like little feelers out there, that birds actually have bristles.
Right. That was actually my first research project in graduate school. I filmed these birds at 400 frames per second and watched how they use their bristles. They don't use them to catch flies. What we think they're used for is to indicate how fast a bird is going. So he turns left, turns right. He knows, just like when you close your eyes, you know which way you're going and you know where your arms are. Well, the bristles do the same thing. They tell the bird how fast he or she is going and, you know, in what direction and down, up, and those kinds of things.
My guests are Carol Burr and Roger Lederer, and they have collaborated on the book Latin for Bird Lovers. Roger is an ornithologist, and Carol's specialty is language, literature, and so they've collaborated on this book that includes lots of words. And Carol, you probably were in charge maybe of the listing of the nomenclature, the two, and of course binomial means two names.
Yes.
Why don't you explain how that came about, or what you, the work you did for the binomial, that is redundant, actually, binomial nomenclature, but forgive me.
That's definitely really Roger's initiative, but we wanted to include the genus and the species, it's a way of understanding the relationship between birds, and of course our understanding of what constitutes a species is that the birds can interbreed and produce healthy offspring, and I think that's probably still the main taxonomical reason for determining, and apparently there's a lot of change. One of the things we sort of did a caveat in the introduction is that because of DNA and other things, it's changing.
It's
a moving target, very much so, and it's getting more and more sophisticated with the DNA analysis. But I think that was why there the other side pieces, in addition to the names, is a discussion of the different genera, the different, to some extent family as well. But we focused on the genus and the species, like Homo and sapiens. And Homo is, of course, the larger category, but then sapiens is the one that we, as opposed to erectus or some of the other species categories.
You also, here's the English teacher, and you give a warning to the reader about the word species is both singular and plural.
Well, the species has nothing to do with species.
That is a word, yes.
It is a word. It is a word.
It's a gold coin.
It's a gold coin, yes. It will not help you with ornithology. But, that's also true, that genuses is not what it's generally. And so I guess we sort of were, you know, trying to kind of make that accurate so that because I think what's appealing about this to some extent is that when you are a bird watcher and common names, even though Roger has explained that there are official common names for birds that are understood internationally, but frequently birds will have more than one sort of regional name that's been given to the bird, and so this is really a way of understanding birds globally, and I think it's one of the few animals that has this clarity in terms of naming. So it's appropriate.
Right, exactly. The whole purpose of scientific name, well, it's two purposes. One is to put the birds in a relationship with every other organism. Every living organism has a scientific name. And they all have a classification, started with kingdom, and we go through fish or birds or whatever it happens to be. And so every scientific name denotes exactly where these organisms lie in the whole scheme of biology. And it gives international workers a way to communicate with one another. I've been to international congresses, you know, with people speaking different languages, and if we had a different name for every bird, we wouldn't know what we're talking about. So they have specific common names. But as Carol said, I mean, specific scientific names, but as Carol said, there are common names. The International Ornithological Congress has decided on common names for all 10,000 birds, common English names. Now, they may call them something else in Africa or Asia, but in English-speaking countries, there are official common names. It makes it a lot handier for us, especially when we go on bird walks and we say, that's a scrub jay and not a F.L. Coma cirrolescens, which people couldn't write down nearly as fast.
It's very interesting. And, of course, some of the bird names, some of the scientific names are based on the call, the bird call. And so Roger has the one that's become the most popular when we're explaining this.
You know, people ask about that. What's your favorite name or favorite bird? And I don't really have one, but the one that's most interesting to me is there's a bird called a hoopoe, which you may have seen because you were in France lately. They are in France. He's like a little orange kind of woodpecker that pokes on the ground. Really interesting bird. It's one of a kind. It's its own species and genus and family and order. And it's Eupupa epops is a scientific name. It's named after the sound as well as the name hoopoe. But it also has its own family, Eupupidae, and its own order, Eupupiformes. So when I give this talk sometime, I'll say this bird is in Eupupiformes, Eupupidae, Eupupa epops, the hoopoe.
He's the only one I know who can say that.
Well, that sounds like the sound that the bird makes. So
yes.
That's the source of some names, the sound that the bird makes himself. I'm always interested in that in other languages when the name of the bird, commonly used, is the sound that the bird makes, an imitation of that. You mentioned that some of them are named for the person, not really the person that maybe gave the name,
right. But
named for some person.
It is an honorary thing. I mean,
So you don't name it for yourself.
You don't name it for yourself.
That's sort of unwritten rule. You don't do that.
Right. And it's generally meant as a kind of a tribute to that person. I know when Audubon named the Bewick's wren, it was named after Thomas Bewick, or Bewick, depending on which Englishman you talk to. He was an ornithologist in England, and so you know, when you come to the names, it's sort of interesting because you'd learn a little bit about the person for whom the bird was named. So
they're named for people, for the sound they make.
Yes, for their behavior.
For their behavior.
Right, for their habitat in some cases, for their coloration, for their, for example, whether they have a crest on the top of the head or whether they have bands on the wings, the shape of the tail. And so there are some words that you'll find repeating themselves because they're rinkus for nose and wura for tail and... I'm trying to think, cephala for head, and you'll find that a number of the names, then you start going, oh, there's another cephala, another thing where it's something about the shape of the head or the color of the head. And one example that Roger has explained, and I think it's fascinating, is the bald eagle, which actually is not bald. Obviously, it has white feathers, and that's because the bald is actually coming from piebald. I thought that was an interesting kind of explanation of something. You're going, why is it a bald eagle? Well, no, it's a piebald eagle. Mm-hmm. So it's actually a lot of fun when you start noticing all the different reasons for the bird name. And most of them are descriptive. Some of them are based on mythology, which can throw you completely for a loop. And then the origin of the language is really Indo-European, but it came through the Greek and then the Latin. And so you have some names that are really looking quite Greek in origin. Mm-hmm. Others that are clearly Latin, and then some that you're going, okay, well, they obviously wanted to make it like the sound of the bird, and it's not coming from anywhere familiar. And then the mythology is very complicated.
Well, can you give us an example of one name for behavior of the bird?
Okay, now I did. I wrote something down on that. Let's see if I can do this here. The red-winged blackbird, Agelaeus phoeniceus, is named for its behavior because it's a gregarious bird, and that's where the Agelaeus comes from. And then also in the phoeniceus, that's a wing coloration, which is deep red. So sometimes you'll get a combination of behavior and color. Or, and habitat. Let me see, what do we find? What did I find for habitat?
You can think, common names, Savannah sparrow and marsh wren and those kinds of things,
right.
Reed warbler.
Now, you mentioned color.
Yes.
And something that I found fascinating was that this bird we call the red-breasted robin, and you think, well, but that's not red. And I grew up, my hair isn't very red now, but I grew up, people call their hair red, but it really wasn't red. It was orange.
Right.
And I found out from reading your book about the color orange.
Right.
And what happened with that?
They didn't have a word for orange at the time. It was all sort of one color, red. I mean, like now, when you go to paint samples, you know, 10,000 different names for blue or red. Well, they only had simple names for those things, and they only had a few dyes here and there, so they just didn't have one for orange.
Right.
Well, my husband always thought that men in particular were limited in their range of colors. They knew about three basic colors. And so I thought about that when you said you said the color orange wasn't even known as a color until the 16th century.
16th century, right.
That was amazing to me. So mm-hmm. this red-breasted robin, of course, is actually orange. So the terminology, the names that are applied, sometimes puzzle us, like you were talking about the bald eagle. What were some other surprises as you researched these names?
Well, I mean, there's some like the red-bellied woodpecker doesn't have a red belly, but it has a little tiny pink wash. And that came from the fact that whoever named it had it in his hand, a dead specimen, saw the pink very close up and said, oh, a red-bellied woodpecker. But you see it in the field, you can't find that red belly. So there are a number of things like that that come from artifacts. And some of these things they've cleaned up, and some they just, you know, it's just sort of interesting. So they'll keep it, everybody understands.
My guests are Roger Lederer and Carol Burr. Roger is an ornithologist, and Carol's specialty was English language. So you collaborated on this, and you mentioned, Roger, you're often asked about your favorite bird, and you like the name, saying the name. I have a favorite bird, too, and that's the crow. And so I was very interested in what you had to say about the crow. What do people find interesting about crows?
They're very smart. Some of them are particularly smart. It depends on which crow you're talking about. There are bunches of them, but they're all, the whole crow family is probably the most intelligent of birds. There have been studies on New Caledonian crow, which is a special species just found in New Caledonia. They can actually make tools. Now, some birds use tools, but they actually make tools, break little branches, make little hooks out of them so they can get the fruit and things like that. Lots of experiments done on crows. Corvus brachyrhynchos, the crow with a wide bill.
Well, speaking of bills, because you have a section in your book, one of these topics is on beaks, and you say that the beaks are a reflection of a bird's lifestyle. And there's a photograph. By the way, your book visually is so reader-friendly. I really enjoyed, and maybe your editor did all that, but it was very easy to read. You'd have boxes, Latin in action over on the side, beautiful color pictures of the birds.
Yeah, they did a nice job.
They did a beautiful job visually. So I get this picture of the rhinoceros hornbill, and that is really a bizarre beak.
Right.
Describe to people what that beak looks like.
Well, it's a big, heavy beak, that down-curved beak, but on top of it is another horn, rhinoceros kind of horn that sticks up. And what most hornbills do is the male walls a female in a hole in a tree and then walls it in with mud so the female can only stick her beak out and he can only stick his beak in, and she raises the eggs and young in there. It's a way of protection. And if a predator comes along, they stick their beak out, big, heavy beak, both for feeding and for protection.
Yeah, so here's this bird that has one beak. I mean, most beaks are rather elegant looking. They're, I think, visually pleasing. And here's this bird with this rhinoceros horn on top of his beak. And that really is bizarre looking.
Yeah, the shoebill that we saw in Uganda was an incredible looking beak. So maybe you can explain a little bit about that.
Well, it's a big, odd bird. It's about five, 6 feet tall, fairly rare, and it's got a beak as big as a size 12 shoe, and it looks like a shoe.
Looks like a shoe.
Yeah.
That's hard to imagine.
Pretty amazing. But what I said about birds' beaks are reflect their lifestyle, because that's their tool. If you had only one tool, like you had a pair of pliers or you had a hammer, and that's all you had, that's all you can make your living with, there's only certain things you can do. And so birds with really long bills live very different life than birds with really short bills and so on.
Well, and that whole thing with the Galapagos finches, because each island had a different food source to some extent, so the beaks reflected the food source and what the birds needed to survive on that particular island. I mean, that was something that Darwin really did quite a bit of work on. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. It is, this whole thing that you can look at the bird's beak and tell what his lifestyle is. What always amazes me, too, when I find a bird's nest, say, on the ground or a tree, and I look at that and imagine I could not possibly, with my 10 fingers and tools at my disposal, create what this bird has created with his beak and a talon. I find that incredible.
Typically, just with the beak, they may bring, certain birds can bring things in, but most of them will just use their beak, and some of them will take weeks. The weaver birds of Africa will take 3 or 4 weeks to build a big, long hanging nest up in a tree somewhere so predators can't get to them. So, and some of them, the oven birds of South America, will build these birds that look like bake ovens that the natives used to use, all made out of mud.
But I'm always astounded that with just that beak, they can build that. Yep. And I also was interested in the fact that the beak has some parts that are sensitive and some parts, obviously, like our fingernails and hair, we can cut our fingernails and hair, we don't feel any pain. But skin is in that same thing. We feel that in the skin. So how does a bird's beak help them in as far as sensitivity?
Well, the birds that are probing in the ground are probing like in sand, like a whimbrel or some or a willet, something like that. They'll stick their bill into the sand, and they can find prey that way. And they can actually don't have to touch it. They don't have to feel it. They don't have to see it. They can sense it with pressure-sensitive corpuscles in their bills. And then they can find out where this thing is.
Yeah, that is amazing to me. My guests are Roger Lederer and Carol Burr. And they have collaborated on a book, Latin for Bird Lovers. And that's the title here in the United States, and I think in England, Latin for Bird Lovers. But I understand in Australia, they've given it a different title.
Latin for Bird Watchers.
Bird Watchers.
Yeah, I don't know why they did that. I sort of argued for the Latin for Bird Watchers in the first place, but the people who know about marketing and things like that and the publishing, they said they decided Bird Lovers. I said, well, okay.
Well, when I was back before now, I considered people who were interested in birds, bird watchers, and they call themselves, I hear around Chico, birders.
Well, there's a fine line of difference. It's like bird watchers are generally considered people sitting in their kitchen and looking out at the birds at their feet or walking down the block and seeing a couple of finches in the gutter somewhere. And while birders are out, they go out to go watch birds. That's their whole purpose in life, or when they go out and look for things.
But they're the big ear people. Did you see the film with Steve Martin? It was about these guys competing to who could see the most North American birds in a year, and one went bankrupt in the process. I mean, these are people who are diehard. The birders.
I know some people who travel all over the world doing
that. Solely for that.
So there is a distinction then between bird watchers and birders.
Yeah,
and
but it's a pretty loose distinction. In England, they call them twitchers, the avid bird watchers.
Thank you for taking us on this fascinating adventure with birds.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My guests have been Roger Lederer and Carol Burr, and their new book is Latin for Bird Lovers. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, kcho.org. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.